It's Friday, April 15th, 2005, 10:06 a.m. on the central coast of California. It's time now for Geek Speak. Welcome to Geek Speak, bridging the gaps between geeks and the rest of humanity. My name is Lyle Troxell. Please keep in mind the views expressed during Geek Speak are not necessarily those of KUSP.
All of us at Central Coast Public Radio thank everyone, and us at Geek Speak too. We'd like to thank everyone who made a pledge during our spring membership drive. We fell $15,000 short of our goal, but your online pledges since Friday have cut that shortfall by over $3,000. You can close the gap even more by making a web pledge right now at KUSP.org. Go to the web and push the big blue button, and thank you for all your support.
Today on Geek Speak, after a spot of geek news, we're speaking with Editor-in-Chief of Microprocessor Report, Kevin Kurwell, all about microprocessors, of course. Lots of new stuff is coming our way. Stay tuned for that. During the second half of the show, welcome to join our conversation. The phone numbers are 476-2800 or toll-free at 1-800-655-5877. Of course, you can go to geekspeak.org and click on Contact Us. I'll give out that contact information again when I invite your participation in about a half an hour. This is Geek Speak. My name is Lyle Troxell, the geek in the air room with me. This morning is Sean Cleland, Senior PR Marketing Manager. Welcome, Sean, to Geek Speak.
Good morning. I just want to say I'm very excited about today's show. We have Kevin Kurwell on the show. He's the Editor-in-Chief of Microprocessor Report. The Microprocessor Report is a bunch of very important analysts in the microprocessor world. It's kind of large over in Silicon Valley and all throughout the world now. And Kevin, he not only is the Editor-in-Chief of the report, but he also put on a couple trade shows throughout the year. We'll talk about all of that. But if you want to learn about what's going on in the microprocessor world, consumer, workstation, with Intel, AMD, Sony, IBM, I mean, we're going to talk about it all. So it's going to be pretty interesting. But let's get to news. So we have the Xbox as a new name for the Xbox. Next generation Xbox has been confirmed. It's the Xbox 360.
Why 360?
I guess because they expected to use it 360 days. I don't know. A year?
Must be about a circle in degrees.
It's got to be something about a circle, right?
It's probably going to be round.
They really haven't given any details about the box itself. I don't know. Maybe Kevin can give us a little insight as to what chips they'll be using. We'll see. But that's kind of interesting. Xbox 360. A bionic suit, a robot suit, has been unveiled in Japan at the World Expo in Aichi, Japan, last month. This is kind of interesting. It's very, very futuristic. It uses bioelectric sensors attached to the skin to monitor nerve impulses from the brain to muscles, indicating that movement, like standing or walking, is about to take place, and then it does it for you. So what they're hoping to do is it's get older people and those with disabilities that can't walk or lift heavy objects. They'd strap this exoskeleton suit on and use it. So, I mean, this kind of thing is, you know, the bionic suit is definitely here. And
get a picture of it? Let me see.
Yeah, it's kind of really wild.
Wow, what a kick.
I mean, like it looks very futuristic.
Additions to people's bodies that makes them
Straps onto your whole body. But very interesting technology. Hopefully we'll learn more about it in the future.
I want to cover something. There's always this kind of it's pretty common to see news stories that are very sensationalized kind of news stories. There's at ZDNet, they're covering an article about how Americans that were surveyed, only 2,500 of them, support blog censorship. Blog are weblogs. They're basically personal journals of people writing. It's I think of blogs as kind of the in the early days of the press in the United States, people that could buy the press equipment, could buy a press and ink, could go ahead and make a newspaper print, and they could do that. And there's a lot of stuff built into the Constitution to support people doing that, publishing themselves. And that's what the press is about, right? So the current day press are these blog things. So basically people have a website that they can add content to quite easily, and it's generalized called a blog. Most people don't know about what they are and how they work, but in a recent survey, people were talking about how the restrictions should be put up on these people. And
a lot of these people are reporting the news.
That's right.
They don't have the right credentials to do that.
There is no credentials you need to report news, actually. You and I don't have credentials. But
no. But they're not – they're citing – they're saying things possibly they shouldn't be doing.
Yeah, but you can't decide that. So I, in any case, I am very against
the
idea.
Can they withhold sources?
Kind of,
you know, can they say anything they want and
I personally
say they have a source, but they can't, you know, disclose the source? Because
I guess only if you're in
journalistic
print.
Yeah, it's
only
kind of interesting.
If you're in print, yeah. All right.
This is kind of interesting piece of news. There's a new alloy has been invented by DuPont to hold nuclear energy, spent nuclear fuel. This is the new alloy that uses it's going to be fabricated in large quantities using conventional ingot metallurgy. So basically they found it's called gadolinium nickel alloy. What's nice about this is you can use just regular fusion welding techniques, and this material actually can absorb the plutonium, the radioactive energy from the spent fuel rods.
Mm-hmm.
So they can be transported safely. So much better than the materials they have now. So very, very excited about that. I thought it was going to be interesting to mention.
I mean, of course, I mean, the idea, of course, is to take all these spent fuel rods that are sitting in pools all over the place, sitting in pools of water, and make them travel to large storage facilities. It makes sense more to me to reuse them, but of course there's a lot of risk involved and a lot of concern about risk involved in that.
So a lot happened this week in microprocessor world. I'm very happy that Kevin's here because a lot of big news this week. And of course, Intel launched their dual core processors this week.
64-bit dual core.
Yes, 64-bit dual core. And AMD...
Not only launched, I mean, but actually got it in the hands of OEM, so we'll see them coming out, which is kind of nice.
Right. And I'm not going to get into specifics because I really want Kevin to talk about these.
All right.
AMD announced their dual-core processor. It's called the Athlon 64X2. Kind of interesting. And we expect to see the Cell processor and more consumer electronics devices by 2007. That's the one that's being co-developed by Sony, IBM, and Toshiba. And it's going to be used in the next-generation PlayStation. So, yeah, let's move on.
All right. Well, we're done with the news. You're listening to Geek Speak. My name is Lyle Troxell. With me in the air room is geek Sean Cleveland, and we're going to be talking about processors. And now, of course, the reason why processors are so important, I mean, what they play is such an important role, it's the brain of the computer, right? And the growth rate of the new technologies and processors is, well, defined by Moore's Law as a doubling rate every 18 months in speed and halving in price. It kind of, the technology behind processors changes faster than any other part of the computer. To talk about processors, what's coming up, these dual cores, define that, talk about cell processors. We've asked Kevin Creewell, editor-in-chief of Microprocessor Report, to come over the hill and join us in the studio, which he has graciously done. Kevin, welcome to Geek Speak.
Thank you.
Oh, let me put your mic on. I think that might be actually kind of nice. There you go. Hi, welcome.
Hi.
There you go.
Great. Oh, I can hear myself now. That's good. That works better.
Yeah. So let's start off by, we just covered a little story about Intel releasing dual-core 64-bit processors. What's a dual core processor?
Basically, and in fact, the definition of what a dual core processor is going to get kind of funky next year. Dual core processors are basically two discretely independent processors, but all on one piece of silicon, so that they've integrated two parts onto one piece of silicon. You know, going back to the Moore's Law issue, is they've each 18 to 24 months they have twice as many transistors to play with. And what do you do with those transistors? And they've pretty much run out of, you know, okay, we could throw more memory on the chip. We can make the chip more complex and try to make it run faster. But we ran into a wall around 3.84 gigahertz on
speed.
And
what's that wall?
Power. They ran into significant heat and power issues trying to just to crank up the clock speed to 4 gig. And
one of the things is that the processor has to be really tightly packed. The transistors have to be as close as possible on the silicon.
Right.
And the idea being that the more you put in there, at some point you're going to get the situation where the transistors just can't radiate the heat out of there fast enough. And therefore, we'll kind of do a meltdown.
Well,
and
yeah,
so the dual
heat
cores,
gets really tight.
The heat density gets tight, right? So the idea with the dual core is you get more performance, but you just make two different processors on the same chip.
Right. But one of the things that maybe people don't realize is that when you go to dual core, you don't run it at the same speed as a single core. So the fastest single core Pentium 4 is, say, 3.8 gigahertz. Well, when you go to the dual core, you back it off to about 3 to 3.2 gigahertz.
Why?
So back to the heat issue. If you put two 3.8 gigahertz processors on the same piece of silicon, well, you'd have twice as much power. You're already running about 110 watts on a 3.8 gigahertz Pentium 4. That would be 220 watts. It's not something you're going to put into
If they could continue with a single core, they probably would.
Yeah.
But the heat's going to be too much.
Yeah. So
120 watts on that little tiny chip?
Yeah.
3.8 gigahertz Intel.
Yeah, when we get to the dual cores, they're going to have 130.
Let's just talk. Okay, wow. So it is more, even though it's reduced in speed.
Yeah.
120 watts, that means you take a 100-watt light bulb that you can't really look at, you know, really bright light. We're talking about that being inside this little black box and not producing any light at all.
Well, that power envelope is the worst case. I mean, if you're running Doom 3 and you really cranked up your game and you're running at high performance, yeah, you're gonna hit that at higher power watt envelope. If your web browser is just sitting there, or you're not actively using a PC, it'll power down to a much lower power number. So, what they designed for is the worst case condition, so that when you really need the power and you really need the performance, your machine doesn't crap out on you.
Right? Yeah, power management technologies are very important right now.
You may know something about that, Sean.
Yeah, but you know what's interesting is instead of shrinking the size of the chips themselves with the transistors inside, they're keeping the real estate the same, but putting another core in and more memory.
Yeah.
And I've heard it because they got to keep the fabs moving, right? They don't.
Well, what they do is, in the case of Intel, is they'll jump on a technology, and initially it's kind of large, but they rely on the next generation shrink to reduce that size.
Right.
But the weird thing they're doing with the Pentium 4, or Pentium D, actually, what they're going to call the dual cores when they come out, is they're doing something different. They are actually going to be doing a part in 65 nanometer, which is the next generation, 2006. There are actually two separate die, but in one package. It's called a multi-chip module. So instead of integrating it all in one silicon, they actually are doing two separate pieces of silicon and putting it in one package.
Oh, really?
So they're
Intel's
doing that. Yeah, it's a part called Pressler.
Okay, so not the Pentium Extreme Edition.
Not the first one that's coming out. Yeah.
Okay.
And what they've done actually in the last week or so is they sent out a bunch of systems to enthusiast websites and
why didn't
the press.
We get one?
Yeah, why did you guys think of it? But they sent out the press. They had people evaluate it, and then they pulled the wraps off and said, okay, you can talk about it. They pulled the NDAs off. Mm-hmm. And they did that this past week, and so all those benchmarks. And there's two different dual-core parts. One's the Pentium D, which is more of a standard Pentium 4 replacement. Then is the Pentium Extreme Edition.
The 840, it's called?
I think so. Actually, I don't remember the numbers off the top of my head.
Okay.
But the and the difference between the two parts are really come down to one thing. The dual core, the Pentium D's, it's two processors and two threads, as you may think about it, a two-way system. With the Pentium Extreme Edition, they actually enable a thing called hyper-threading, which is the threading that they put in the Pentium 4. So you now have four virtual processors on one die, but it's two physical cores. So a Pentium Extreme Edition is basically a virtual four-way machine.
Interesting, but it's all in one chip.
Yeah.
And, of course, your software has to support.
Well, yeah, Windows, XP, and Linux does, yeah.
Okay, what about gaming? I mean, are these things good for gaming?
Actually, in the short term, no.
Why not?
That lower clock speed is going to hurt you. All the games today have been highly tuned for a single-core, single-chip performance. There's some enhancements for hyper-threading. Intel's had an Pentium 4 for a couple of years now. But those are relatively minor. Most of the games perform best on a single-core part. So in the short term, for the next year or so, if you want the best Doom 3, Half-Life 2 performance, you're still going to go with a single core.
Okay, let's say you could buy a single core Pentium right now, the highest speed 3.8 gigahertz Pentium machine. You want to buy a game box. In a year from now, would one of these duals be better for the newest games coming out? Versus that single processor?
It's hard to say yet. We think so. I think there's been a lot of work in the game community. I was at GDC, Game Developer Conference 05, and everybody was talking about how to design for multi-core. If you look at all the console games that are coming out, the console platforms that are coming out, by the way, the Xbox 360, the reason it's called 360, it's a pretty reliable conjecture. And that is, they were going to call it Xbox 2, but the next PlayStation is called PlayStation 3. So that makes the Xbox 2 sound like it's a back generation.
Yeah, you can't do that, right?
No, so they call it 360, and there's that 3 in there, so they're competitive with the PlayStation 3.
Right.
Well, did they think about naming it like CS, like Photoshop did? Well, that makes sense.
Something
to do
altogether
that.
Different.
Yeah, right. All right, let's. We have a lot of Mac listeners, as Sean will attest to. I've got a Mac in front of me, for example.
Okay.
What's going on in the Mac world with the power PCs? And IBM is making them now. Motorola's
right.
not.
Motorola
are we
going to
see a dual
some.
Coming out? Okay.
They make the G4s. And in fact, the Mac Mini might use a Motorola processor. It's not sure if it's a Motorola IBM because both the G4s are both companies. The G5s were made mostly by IBM actually. And you really have to expect sometime this year that there's going to be a dual-core G5 coming. And in the Mac world, actually, all this dual-core stuff is a no-brainer because you've had dual-processing G5s for a while now, before G4s. So therefore, software like Adobe and the photo and video editing software, they're all threaded. They're actually the applications that will best use multi-core processors because... they've already been there. They've already done that development work.
Right. Okay. So we're going to see them come out, and they'll be amazing?
You'll probably see the same issue you see with the heat issue, yeah. So you'll probably see it back off a little bit on frequency in order to get the dual cores on one chip.
And they probably won't go into notebooks anytime.
Well, we still have a G5 notebook yet.
Right, right.
I remember years ago when we started seeing the gigahertz processors a couple years ago, maybe 4 years ago, Sean and I did some overclocking, you know, to see where you could pump it. And the way to really get a processor to perform a lot better, a lot faster, if you will, and therefore better, was to make sure it cooled down really well. And there's people doing, like, liquid-cooled systems. And in supercomputers in the old days, what you did is you really focused on your heat dissipation. The Crays have an amazing system to get rid of heat.
Yeah, have you ever been to the Computer History Museum to see the
sure.
Crays there?
We've had them on the show.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. 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 Great.
So the question is...
You had the whole Cray here?
No. Not here, no.
the question that I have then is when you get this 3.8 gigahertz processor or these duals that have to run slower because of the heat, couldn't you build an enclosure that had liquid nitrogen in it and really cooled them down and therefore got better performance?
Yes, you could. And in fact, you could overclock probably the Pentium Extreme Edition. And some people do that. I mean, there was one company that did introduce a 4 gigahertz Pentium 4, but basically by overclocking at 3.8. The issue is that's not a mainstream solution for a guy like Dell. The expense of putting all those big heat sinks and cooling systems, they're not cheap and they're not high volume. What everybody's relied on in the past is we just wait a little while longer and Intel will have a faster part.
Right.
So why bother putting all those big expensive heat sinks on that are more expensive than the processor sometimes?
Okay, so that comes down to do we really need a faster processor? Aren't we kind of done? That comes out every time, right?
Some people do need a faster processor.
Yeah.
I don't know if gamers do so much.
Oh, come on. Gamers are the most extreme. They're the guys who overclocked the earliest.
Yeah, but, you know, I think people have in their mind that a faster processor is going to get them a faster game, when in truth, a faster video card would do much better.
Well, yeah, but assuming you've maxed out your video card.
If you've maxed out your video card, but this thing's are $500-$600 now.
Yeah, but you do an SLI NVIDIA solution.
Yeah.
And you've maxed out. So, you're now compute intent. You're compute bound, I should say.
So tell us about SLI. That's interesting technology.
Well, SLI is kind of interesting. It actually, in many ways, is a throwback to the 3DFX days.
Yeah, yeah.
I did an SLI 3DFX
where you used two, instead of one video card, you used two.
Yeah.
And the motherboards made specifically...
Well, in the old days, you didn't need a specific
motherboard. That's right, you didn't.
Uh-huh. Yeah, because that was before AGP. Yeah,
hey, guys.
PCI cards.
Just two PCI
cards.
You're losing me, so you're obviously losing everybody else.
Sorry.
So what's SLI?
Scalable Link Yeah, scalable link interface, I think.
Stacking doesn't matter. What does it do?
It basically allows you to put two video cards into one PC to give you almost twice the performance.
Yeah.
Not two monitors, just still one monitor, but they're both working together?
Yeah, they're both working together. They actually share the screen, updating the screen.
Does the game have to understand how to use that?
No, actually, an NVIDIA do.
Oh, really?
The drivers have to be tuned to each particular game.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah, there's a little gotcha to that.
Now, do most of the games have that ability?
They have to go back and tune the games. But, you know, the games that can really use that are very high-end games like Half-Life 2 and Doom 3, Far Cry, and those are all pretty much been tuned up.
Mm-hmm. Now, Bruce Damer, who runs the DigiBarn in Boulder Creek, he's a famous person in the virtual reality world. He had an opening years ago, and Sean and I went to it, I believe. And somebody had, I think it was Quake 2, I can't recall what game it was, maybe it was Half-Life, I'm not sure. He had a large 3D monitor so that you had to wear glasses. And he had the game playing with two video cards, or somehow was able to create the 3D effect in what we consider 3D in movie theaters, you know, where the objects were actually three-dimensional.
Right.
Two eyes would get two different signals. I'm wondering, how is that the same kind of technology that this dual processor or this dual card thing?
It could be used that way. So far, I don't know if anybody's doing that in a consumer space. The biggest problem with it is you need two monitors,
or you need effectively two monitors, built into one.
You can do it built in one, and you can do this, but you don't need actually two video cards to do that. And you could break out the two channels and do the glasses where they do a shutter effect where they switch back and forth. I've seen
those were very popular in the late 90s.
But the only problem is only the wearer can get that 3D effect, and a lot of games just aren't tuned to it. It's not a mainstream solution yet, so it's kind of a trick, but it's not something that's really taken off.
Okay, back to processors. I hear this term, the cell processor, all the time. What is the cell processor?
And it has nothing to do with cell phone, just to start off with.
Good to know.
Yeah. Just read a Forbes article talking about Broadcom, and then they mentioned cell as a competitor to Broadcom, and it's like, no. But the problem is they see cell, and they think it has something to do with cell phones or cellular communication, and it doesn't. Cell processor is actually named because Sony wanted to create this sort of encapsulated processor environment where code and instructions kind of move together to a processor, and then it can move from processor to processor, and you can distribute this over a large area. It could be over the internet, and then all these cells could cooperate together. And then the first cell processor was developed mostly in Austin, but you know, different groups, with IBM as a lead designer. With Sony and Toshiba as partners in developing this processor, and it's designed. First application is the PlayStation 3, although Sony hasn't really called it the PlayStation 3, but it's pretty much known that what they plan to do call it. And it's capable of 4 gigahertz operation. It's tuned for math processing. That's good for video graphics, physics.
Video graphics with multiple
cores,
cells or something?
Yeah.
How would that work? I mean, it's going to be really fast response time.
A very fast bandwidth.
High bandwidth. Very so we're talking about, this is really for supercomputer formats, right?
Very similar. The only difference is in the esoteric world of math and processing on computers, there's two types of formats for floating point, which is the math functions that most people use, and single precision and double precision. Single precision is good enough for your PC.
Right.
It's good enough for games, and that's what Cell is tuned for. The scientific guys really want double precision, and that runs about 1/10 the speed on the Cell. But it's that's why the Cell off the bat isn't really a great supercomputer chip, but it could be tuned to it.
Right.
All right.
Yeah.
So I think I understand it.
It's actually a really complex, really interesting chip, and the big challenge is going to be programming it. There's a lot of people that are looked at the cell and realize that this is going to take a lot of work to program it to get it really tuned up to work well.
Is this kind of a fundamental shift in the way you think about processors in some way?
In some ways. If you look at what they're trying to do, they have a really specific market they're going after, and that they call it broadband. They actually call it a broadband architecture. And they're going after video games, HDTV processing, and those have different needs than your standard desktop, Outlook and Word and Excel and all that. So they re-architected the chip so it's tuned for those applications. And so it's a little odd in many ways. It's not a general-purpose processor. And it does have a power core in it, so you could run Linux on it. You could run maybe Mac OS on it. We don't know yet. But then they have all these eight little synergistic processing elements, which are really tuned for processing this floating point math and these specific calculations used to create virtual worlds.
Not going to replace the Pentium.
Not going to replace the Pentium.
Yeah.
Yeah. And that's the other thing to keep in mind is that this is a power core, not an x86 core.
Right.
So it's not a PC competitor. But there's actually an answer. The PC guys, this company called AGEIA, that develop a math co-processing chip that they want to introduce later this year for the PC market that would give the PC the same kind of like floating point performance that you get out of the Cell chip.
Cool. This program is supported by a grant from Santa Cruz Electronics, offering an extensive selection of computer and electronic parts as well as support services. Santa Cruz Electronics is open daily at 2808 SoCal Avenue and online at santacruzelectronics.com.
The Santa Cruz County United Nations Association presents a South African dinner and fundraiser for HERO, a UN program to help educate at-risk orphans whose parents have died of AIDS on Wednesday, April 27th at 6:30 p.m. Reservations are required, so please call 426-3101 or 423-9707 for more information.
This is Geek Speak. My name is Lyle Troxell. If you have questions or comments, the phone numbers are 476-2800 or toll-free at 1-800-655-5877. Of course, you can use the Internet. Visit geekspeak.org and click on Contact Us. We'll take any of your questions or comments today. Next time on This American Life, backed into a corner. Employees of a Quiznos sub shop are left high and dry when the franchise owners disappear. They keep going to work, but start running out of supplies. Soon they don't even have bread. So the manager takes matters into her own hands, and a truck driver tells the story of a traveling all over the country making deliveries without knowing how to read. Plus other stories about what people do when their options begin to run out. That's This American Life, Sunday at 10, right after Car Talk on Central Coast Public Radio KUSP. This is Central Coast Public Radio, KUSP. You're listening to Geek Speak. My name's Lyle Troxell. In the air, I'm with me is Sean Cleveland and Kevin Crewell. We're talking about processors. You're welcome to join the conversation or call us about another question if you'd like. The phone numbers are 476-2800 or toll-free at 1-800-655-5877. Of course, you can send us email by going to geekspeak.org. This program is supported by a grant from Cruise.io, providing Internet services including DSL, spam filters, PHP, and MySQL. Now with nationwide access, information about Cruise.io membership is available online at cruise.io.com or by calling 459-6301. Please feel free to call us with questions or comments about processors or in general anything your computer might need for your technical life answered. The phone number is 476-2800 or toll-free at 1-800-655-5877. All right, back to processors. Sean, you know about processors. You just left a processing company, Transmeta, who's really changed the way they're doing things. Got any questions that are really pertinent to our discussion with Kevin?
Yeah. So the size of chips, processors, you think they'll stay the same size? Or do you think they'll just keep throwing more cores on? Will they shrink the size down and utilize the performance in smaller spaces? You know, or is it heat? We always come back to heat.
Yeah, actually, all of the above. There's going to be a mix of stuff. We talk about AMD and Intel as the two lead suppliers of PC processors.
Yeah.
You have IBM, Motorola doing power PCs. There's another company, VIA, that does really small, compact x86 processors, and they try to keep their die sizes really as small as possible.
Yep.
Their chips very not very complex. And there's really good applications for that type of technology as well. AMD has made a statement that they, Fred Weber, their CTO, wants to take x86, which is the instruction word for PC processors, everything from handheld devices up to servers. And we're moving our way up well into servers, but he wants to take it to very high-end servers eventually.
Right.
Is that feasible?
I
don't think it's actually feasible because when you come to the business of cell phones and PDAs, ARM, another instruction set, really owns that business. And
right.
I think AMD's got a long way to go to try to really compete with ARM in an environment where ARM is really tuned for very low power, long battery life, small, very small form factors like handheld devices. And it's been tough to get x86.
ARM is definitely everywhere. It's powering Palm, right?
Yeah. You don't know where ARM. You never hear about ARM because it's buried in devices that you use all the time, like your cell phone. But you don't hear about it. You don't hear what processors in the cell phone.
Yeah, they don't brand it like Intel brands their chips or AMD does theirs.
Yeah,
it's kind of interesting. Do you think x86 has you know, any life in that space? Is there any, you know, compelling reason to move, you know, Windows down to your cell phone?
Well, except for getting a blue screen,
you know, on an emergency call in the middle of the night when you're trying to change your tire.
Keep getting your patches downloaded automatically. That's the great part about it. You'll be always connected, so you can always get your patches. Actually, you know, your old company, Transmeta, tried to get into a few very small form factor handheld XP devices like OQO. And those just haven't hit the market yet.
No. And I think they're cost prohibitive.
Yeah, they're trying to pack so much into a very tight space and yet get performance that people expect. And it's tough to...
So they were trying to do the personal computer, you know, in the hand where it's like a palm form factor, but it's a full computer.
That's tough to do.
Very, very interesting. The display technology, I think, was a limiting factor for a long time, but they finally got past that.
Yeah.
And I was very impressed with OQO. Mm-hmm. I actually played with it for a day, and I could see where people might use it. It's an executive toy.
With all the technology packed into it, it's only an executive toy because it's cost so much, right?
Right.
Yeah.
All right, let's get to some more general questions from San Miguel. Robin, welcome to Geek Speak.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Certainly.
My old computer, a Sony VAIO that runs Windows 98, have been passed through me to my niece to now to my mother-in-law. And my mother-in-law, without consulting any of us, bought a printer that doesn't communicate with the computer.
Windows 98? It doesn't...
98, yeah.
Uh-huh.
And several of us have spent hours trying to make things jibe, and it said we didn't have the right drivers. We've done everything, including downloading the right drivers, and it still won't communicate. And I'm not sure if part of the problem is that it's a 2-gig machine, but only like 62 KB are free, and I can't figure out where that all that stuff is.
Okay, well, it sounds like you're looking at the memory on the machine.
So I'm wondering, I'm thinking there's like, We never ran any kind of spyware or antivirus, and I'm sure it's full of stuff like that. And so I'm wondering if reformatting the hard drive and re-downloading Windows 98 is going to solve the problem, or should I go another route?
Okay, what's the speed of your machine? What's the processor speed of the machine?
Oh, criminy, I can't remember.
You don't know, okay. Yeah. Do you know the model number of your file? No.
Do you have the original disks with the operating system?
Yeah. Right.
Yeah, because Windows 98, I don't think it can be downloaded.
You can't download it.
You won't be able to download it.
We just downloaded the drivers for the printer.
Okay, and they have Windows 98 drivers for that printer?
Well, evidently, because we went through the HP website and we put in all the information and it told us exactly.
Because it's pretty common now to buy equipment like a printer or something, a peripheral, and only have it being supported in Windows XP. That's not uncommon because basically every time a new printer or new peripheral is created, drivers have to be created. And drivers for Windows 98 versus XP can be very different.
Yeah, once Microsoft dropped support for Windows 98, most companies stopped supporting it as well.
The other thing, issue might be if it's a USB printer or a parallel port.
Oh, yeah.
USB is not great on Windows 98.
How does it plug into your computer?
It's parallel.
Okay.
Well,
that's a good sign, I guess.
Yeah.
I would be tempted to upgrade your machine, your VAIO, to Windows XP. You probably do have viruses on the machine. That's not uncommon, and you've been around for a while on it. It's possible you don't. Do you have a high-speed Internet connection at your house?
No.
Okay, you might not. What kind of email client do you use?
That machine was Netscape.
Okay. Well, what's our recommendation?
Do you know how much memory is in the machine? Because that'll dictate whether it's wise to move to Windows XP. Windows XP requires at least 128 megs of memory.
And you got to differentiate the RAM from the hard drive.
From the hard drive, yeah. And hard drive space, you're going to need probably 3 to 4 gigs when it's all said and done.
Yeah.
These are things to consider.
Should I try cleaning? Should I get a spyware and a virus software and try to clean it up that way, or should I just reformat?
Yeah, I don't think that's your problem, though. I don't think that's preventing your printer from hooking up to your machine.
Okay.
It's not that you have a virus or spyware.
Robin, let me give you a list of things to do.
Okay.
Here goes. First off, you want to find out how fast your processor is, how much RAM you have, and how much hard drive space you have versus, or how large your hard drive is versus how much space you have left in your hard drive.
Okay.
I'm going to start with the last one first. What you want to do is you want to click on, double click, or right click, if you will, on My Computer, which is on the desktop.
Mm-hmm.
And that will pop up, and there will be a C drive. And I want you to right click on the C drive mm-hmm. and go to Properties.
Okay.
That will give you a list of the size of the machine. It will say, this is how big it is, and this is how much is left.
Okay.
If you don't have a gigabyte left, Sean?
Yeah, you're going to need at least a few gigabytes.
Well, I'm not talking about for upgrade. I'm just talking about just for making sure this machine can function.
Yeah.
Make sure that you've got at least a gigabyte of space. If you don't have a gigabyte of space, your the reason why this machine's not working is because of that. You need some space on the machine for it to breathe, for it to use its caching of RAM and stuff, okay? So make sure you got like a gig. If you don't, there's one of your problems. Next, take a look at your RAM and your processor and can match that up with what XP needs. If you can match what Windows XP needs, then and quite a bit better, actually, if your machine is better than what Windows XP requires, on its recommended, if you will, on the software package, then go ahead and upgrade to Windows XP. That's going to be the best solution. But if you do that, you're going to need a lot of hard drive space on this machine. You geeks want to offer anything else?
The other thing is, have you ever hooked a printer to this PC before?
Yes.
Okay, so at least the parallel port's probably working.
Probably.
Yeah.
Good luck.
Okay.
Sorry we couldn't be more help.
Thanks, guys.
You know, once you get that information, if you go to geekspeak.org, send us an email. Maybe we can help you decide your best course from that point. But we would need a little more information.
All right. We are taking calls with questions or comments about technology. We're also taking emails. Go to geekspeak.org and click on Contact Us. The phone numbers to call us and ask us a question about technology, processes, if you want to be specific to the topic at hand. The phone number is 476-2800 or toll-free at 1-800-655-5877. All right, let's get back to our discussion on processors.
My favorite topic.
Yeah. You kind of live and breathe it. You came in this morning and said, so what are you talking about today? I said processors. And you're like, that's a big subject.
Yeah, it's a huge subject.
let's talk about it from the line of somebody going out, they want to buy a computer right now. Is it better for them to buy an Intel, an AMD, or, well, let's not even get into the Mac world, but a Windows machine. Do they want to buy an Intel machine, an AMD machine, and what kind of processor do they need?
Well, actually, it depends on what you want to do with it. Right now, I would say AMD has the edge. Athlon 64s have the edge on gaming boxes. They seem to have better performance overall on most of the game systems. If you're building a media center PC, it gets a little trickier because Intel's Pentium 4 and the next generation Pentium Ds have the dual cores, which are actually great for media center PCs. Media center PCs often are doing multiple things at the same time. Maybe recording a TV show in the background while you want to do something in the foreground, like play a game. And having multiple threads, multiple cores, is a really good way to make sure that all those things, all those different events occur and occur smoothly. So if you're doing a lot of video editing, I'd say a Pentium 4 is a better solution because of the hyper-threading and the dual core coming in that space. What you're going to find, actually going back just for a second to the dual core issue, Intel is going to bring the dual core parts into the desktop space first. AMD's launch, which is next week, of their dual-core Opteron, that's their server processor. So the first market AMD's going after with their dual-core parts are servers.
Mm-hmm.
Intel's actually going after desktops.
Why do you think Intel's going after desktops? I mean, of course, you want the highest performance in servers, so why, and you can get more money.
Well, Intel has, they're doing pretty decent in the server chip right now, aren't they?
Actually, Xeons, which is the Intel server, there's two Intel server chips, Xeon and Itanium. Itanium's for very high-end mainframe style servers. Xeon's for the more mainstream servers. Xeon does very well, but Opteron has been a really good challenge for them.
Yeah.
It's going to take a while for them to actually respond to Opteron. They need a next generation of designs that won't come out to 2007 when they actually fix some of the
issues. So AMD sees it's growing with its Opteron into the server space, and so it's going to keep attacking the server space and try to get in there strong.
AMD's always had a struggle in terms of making money, too. They've gone through periods of times where they've lost money, then made money, then lost money. Server is a good, stable business to be in, and it has good prices, and it'll help make the company more solid.
We got an email from Prunedale from Mary, and she asks, she has a new G5 and often gets these messages about new software is available. Do you want to install it now? How does she know when to do so, and how does she do so when she can? Now, Sean, you probably answer this question, but I'll go ahead and answer it.
I don't have a Mac.
You don't have a Mac. So what you do, Mary, first off, yeah, go ahead and download, go ahead and install anything that Apple's prompting you to install, updates and upgrades and stuff like that. They've got a built-in system that works really wonderfully. You can set it to scan it whenever you want. When the machine ships, it's set up to check it daily or weekly, I can't recall, or every time you boot the machine. And those are security patches and fixes, very much like in the Windows world when you go to Windows Update, not Microsoft.com. And we recommend basically always doing what Microsoft suggests in the upgrade and the security fixes. And the same thing goes with Apple, and probably more so. Both these companies have a major reason not to test their software before they release it into in mass. So unless you hear something, if you want to be really careful, for example, don't upgrade until after GeekSpeak, right? So on GeekSpeak, if we hear about some weird patch that causes a problem, especially on a G5 because they're new machines, well, it's an iMac G5, so that's a pretty machine, by the way. Mm-hmm. we'll tell you about it, and then you can be careful about it. But in general, just do it. So this is how you do it on a Mac. You go up in OS X. You go up to the Apple. It's blue in the upper left-hand corner. You go down to the second choice, which is Software Update, and you select that. And then you say check for software. It will prompt you for a whole bunch of software that you should do. The only things that you don't need to is if you have, like, you don't have a wireless card in there, there's no reason to update your wireless, for example. So just check the boxes that fit your machine, if you will, and say update. It'll ask you for a couple passwords, which is your login password. Do that. Accept their terms of agreements if you agree legally with what they're saying, which you probably shouldn't, but heck, we're users of the software industry, so we do that. And your machine will get upgraded. And there you go. If you'd like to be like Mary and ask us a question pertaining to your computing life, the phone number is 476-2800, toll-free at 1-800-655-5877. If you really want to be like Mary, you go to geekspeak.org and you go to contact us and fill out that form. We'll get that in our email and respond to it. But I'd love to hear your voice online, so, or on the air.
So, Kevin, processors, we've got you here.
Yeah, you do.
And I wanted to, so we said that for gaming, Athlon 64.
Yeah. I forgot to mention for notebooks, actually the Pentium Centrino is a really good solution.
Yeah, that's pretty fast.
Yeah.
Coming from Transmitter.
X-Transmitter.
It is. That's a tough chip to compete with, that's for sure. And now they're moving in a different market. It's kind of interesting.
Yeah, you'll be seeing desktop versions of that part for the small form factor.
Yeah, I hear the Pentium MIM as a desktop chip is pretty fast.
It's not bad. The thing it doesn't have, you go back to the issue I talked about, floating point math.
Yeah.
That's one of the areas they're going to improve on in the next generation. Part that comes next year. And their next generation part that comes in first quarter of 06 called Yona. Most of this development work is done in Israel, the Israeli Design Center, and it looks like a pretty decent part.
Now, we should tell people that floating point, when we talk about floating point, we're talking about math.
Yeah.
And we're not just talking about integers and whole numbers. Yeah. We're talking about the messy math, the ones that need a decimal point, use fractions and that sort of thing, and games and software from Adobe, and when you're crunching digital video, or music, if you've got a processor that can handle floating point operations better, then you're going to see an improvement in performance.
Yeah.
And AMD right now has
the best.
Yeah, the best floating point performance.
Yeah.
So it's that you said for a media center though, a dual core Pentium 4 is better.
Yeah.
Because you can actually do more
things at the same time.
At the same time.
Yeah, that's one of the advantages we didn't talk about much about is the advantages of a dual core is that multiple concurrent tasks, things are going on at the same time, and you can do that with Windows XP. It's what they call a multi-threaded operating system. So you can have multiple things like you're downloading a file through an FPP or a CASA or whatever you're doing in the background, and meanwhile you're playing a game in the foreground or listening to music at the same time. And maybe if you're doing a media center PC, you're actually recording a TV show at the same time.
So a dual core is like having two processors,
like a dual
processor machine.
So that's the situation where they really work.
Yeah, they work really well.
That's the situation I'm in all the time.
Yeah, well, you've got an Athlon MP and a dual
processor.
Athlon MP, and I have one too, system. And I did my just on a Lark. I did the same test. I converted a large AVI file to MPEG, and it's something that took like 10 minutes to do on a regular Pentium 4 system. But, on a dual Athlon MP, it took less than half that time.
Yeah. There are some things that it does really well.
Yeah.
But, like I said, games, until they rewrite the games for these multi-core processors, which they have to do for the Xbox 360 and PlayStation 3, they'll be doing it for PC. So about 2 years, in the next 2 years, you'll see the games that really can use it.
Okay.
We're going to try to take a call. I'm a little confused to where this person is, so. All right, we're going to go with. Nope. Okay, there we go.
Dial tone.
There it is. Soquel, Linda, welcome to Geek Speak.
Hi.
Hi, what's your question?
Well, I am a novice at video editing. I bought a Sony Handycam DV, mini DV camcorder, and I had tried to edit this little dance movie that I made, and through the software I was using was Studio 8. And
Studio 8. Who makes that? Okay, well, go on.
Is that Macromedia?
Or is it, no, I think it's ULEED or
Well, go on. You got Studio 8.
Okay. And when I got everything done on my, I was doing it on the laptop, I had a lot of difficulty in getting it off my laptop, saved into a different format that I could play, like, hopefully I wanted to be able to just be able to play it on, like, a TV.
Okay.
So I was calling to find out what minimum requirements, I guess, or what sort of setup I would need in terms of computer stuff.
Okay, can you give us some more specs on your laptop?
Well, the one I was using was a Dell 8100 Inspiron.
Do you happen to know the processor or RAM on that machine?
No, I don't.
Okay, so you said a Dell what?
8100 Inspiron.
All right, well, I'm searching online to find out what the specs are on that.
Maybe what I should do is call back.
No, it's okay. Let's talk about what you need. Do you have a DVD burner on that machine?
Yes.
You do. Okay. So when you did burn the DVD though, you put it in. Did you succeed in burning a DVD?
Well, the problem I was having was when it was being recorded, it was starting the visual part of it,
mm-hmm.
the picture part would start stuttering.
Okay,
or stopping, and then the audio would continue to go.
Sean, what's that?
It sounds like. What are you using to pull the video and off of the mini recorder? Are you using FireWire?
Is that the
iLink?
Yeah, Sony calls it iLink.
Because it sounds like you're. You're getting it in a raw format. I'm thinking from your camera.
Right.
But it sounds like you possibly don't have the settings right when you're converting it to a compressed format.
Okay.
I'm curious. I think it's probably a software solution, just because, you know, this machine is a 1.13 gigahertz mobile Pentium 3, Pentium 3M.
Yeah.
Okay. 128 RAM, unless you upgraded. 48 gigabyte hard drive, which is probably going to be big enough to do what you need.
It could be if you're trying to compress straight from the camera. It could be that the data stream is not moving fast enough.
Mm-hmm.
That's what's causing the problem, the syncing issue.
Let me tell you the way I do it. First off, doing video editing on a laptop, you know, you kind of have to have the top.
It's going to take a lot of time.
Yeah. So what I do is I take my FireWire, camera or iLink camera, right? And you plug it in and you take all the footage off of there and save your hard drive.
You need
large
to save it to your
AVI.
Hard drive first.
And you make basically an AVI file. It's a raw video file, if you will.
AVI.
And once you've got that, and this thing can be big, you know, it's a massive file,
mm-hmm.
okay? Then you want to open up your video authoring tool. Now, I don't know your software that you're using, but the ones that I think work the best are the suites that allow you to kind of compose a DVD. So you, in the composing the DVD format, you select that AVI file, and you then burn that to a DVD. Now, that's assuming that you haven't edited any video. But if you want to do editing video in there as well, you edit the video, you resave as an AVI, and then you give that AVI to your DVD burning software, DVD creation software, and that will make sure that it gets encoded correctly. But you're going to need a lot of space to do this, because if, for example, you have your RAW file, and then maybe you have two tapes you want to import in, then you got to edit them together, then you save that again as a RAW AVI file. That's a doubling of the space, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then you're going to encode that, if you will. When it's building the DVD, it's going to make this big cache, or basically the re-encode the DVD file, which is going to be an MPEG file. And it's going to be big as well, like 4.5 gigs or something like that. So you're basically going to burn up a lot of space on your hard drive. At the end of that, you should get a successfully burned DVD. But make sure, and this is really important, that your DVD player will be able to play the DVD media that you have. Older DVD players can only do DVD-R-R, and it's possible they won't even play a home recorded DVD.
Yeah, some of the old ones, DVD players don't even play the recorded ones at all.
Yep, and it doesn't matter if you're on a laptop or desktop. I mean, it has to do with your burner and your consumer DVD player. But, you know, doing video on a notebook, I think the biggest prohibitive factor is the hard drive. Because you just don't have the space that you need.
Or speed. Hard drive speeds are slow.
And hard drive speeds are slow. Yeah, and processors are slower. And they usually don't have a lot of memory. So you have a lot of limiting factors on your notebook to do this.
I had bought an external drive, or external hard drive. Someone said that might help.
Yeah.
With that.
Well, that's a great way to do a lot of this. That way you won't run out of space. So you, instead of saving it to your main machine, save the AVI to that hard drive and just use that hard drive as everything. It's going to be a little slower for you, but you know, you can always start the process of encoding the DVD if you will, and then go to sleep. Just make sure your machine won't go to sleep as well, you know.
Okay.
Thank you very much for the call.
Thank you so much.
And good luck.
And if you've got USB 1.0 with an external hard drive, you're out of luck.
Ooh,
that's not going to work.
Yeah.
You need at least USB 2.0 or FireWire. Or iLink with the Sony. Same thing as FireWire.
All right, from San Luis Obispo, we're going to Rob. Rob, welcome to GeekSpeak.
How you doing?
Hi, quite well. What's your question?
I'm looking to upgrade my hard drive, and I'm trying to decide what the differences are between serial ATA, parallel ATA, and SCSI.
Just throw SCSI out the window. Let's not even talk about that, because you're not going to want to do that.
SCSI is old news, and it's going to be very expensive for you. So stick with the consumer-based ATA hard drive, which is the connection technology that your computer already supports.
And it already supports parallel.
And it already supports parallel ATA.
It depends. Unless it has a brand-new PC.
Unless you have a brand-new PC and you have serial ATA ports in it.
Well, my hard drive that I have now is a parallel ATA. And I do look on my motherboard, and I see that I have a serial ATA connection.
Oh, then you're good to go. Yeah.
How recently did you buy your machine?
This is a machine I've been building and upgrading over the years.
Oh, okay. When did you get the motherboard?
The motherboard, probably about 2 years ago. It's a DFI Infinity Pro.
I don't think you have serial ATI on that machine.
No, he might.
It does.
Okay.
It absolutely has one.
Yeah.
I look right through my motherboard instruction manual, and it says serial ATA 150 connection.
Serial ATA is probably the best way to go. I mean, it's a little more expensive per gigabyte, but you get a better performance out of it, and especially if you want to do any kind of video files or large files. It's faster throughput.
Especially, well, you're going to have serial ATA version 1. The version 2 is coming out now, the 300 megabyte per second. Of course, you don't need that kind of bandwidth.
Mine's definitely the 150.
What's nice about the second generation, it has what's called command queuing, where they can line up requests. The hard drive can pretty much know what it needs to do next, and then move the head across the platter in a way that it can get more data than it would normally.
Sean, when you plug in your first serial ATA drive, you had your operating system on a parallel, primary parallel ATA, and it stopped being able to load your OS on the parallel. It just assumed that the serial had the OS and it wasn't able to boot. So what was
What happened is if you want to. The problem with serial ATA is Windows XP does not have the drivers necessary to install itself on a serial ATA hard drive.
Gotcha.
So what you have to do is boot off a Windows XP disk, and right at the very beginning, it'll ask you to press F6 to load, you know, drivers.
Yeah.
You have to do that. You have to press F6. You've got to put the serial ATA driver on a floppy disk, put it in your computer, let it read that driver, and then Windows XP will see the serial ATA hard drive and can install itself. That's a big issue with serial ATA. But if you're just adding a hard drive to an existing computer and you're not going to touch the operating system, you can add a serial ATA hard drive and your Windows will see it. Well, then again, you'll have to load the driver in Windows.
Still do that.
One of the reasons I was actually asking is because I just wanted to make sure that serial was just as stable, because I bought a Maxter hard drive that was serial ATA, and I loaded the drivers on Windows first, and then use their software to copy the entire hard drive onto the new SATA hard drive.
Yeah.
So it worked fine for like 2 weeks, and then all my information completely disappeared off of it.
Sounds like the drive was bad. We can't go on with your call, unfortunately, because we're out of time on GeekSpeak. I appreciate the call. Sounds like a bad drive from the factory. Maybe it got shipped and got damaged or something. This program is supported by a grant from Santa Cruz Electronics, offering extensive selection of computer and electronic parts as well as support services. Santa Cruz Electronics is open daily at 2808 Soquel Avenue and online at santacruzelectronics.com. We have been talking with Kevin Kerwell about processors. He's the senior editor or editor-in-chief of the Microprocessor Report. You're welcome to click over to geekspeak.org to find his site, read more about what he does. Kevin, thank you very much for being here on GeekSpeak today.
Oh, thanks for having me.
That was Kevin Crewell.
Crewell. Sorry, just slaughtering your name. Yes. The geek this morning, who also the literate guy in the house, Sean Cleveland. Thank you very much for being here.
Yep.
Our producer is Maggie Cleveland. And to all of you that called in to ask us questions or emailed us in, thank you very much for making GeekSpeak what it is. Without you, it would just be us geeking out. Who wants to listen to that? Coming up next is Open Road with Matt Pierce. And at 1 p.m., Two Steps in the Blues with Charlie Lang. This is Central Coast Public Radio, KUSP, Santa Cruz, KBDH, San Arto, or on the web at KUSP.org. For KUSP and GeekSpeak, I'm Lyle Troxell. Thanks for listening.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Lakshmi Singh. An investigation is underway into a death.